Christine. Okay, it looks like Article 1 and 2 probably. So if you guys want to come right up. Christine?
John's not here.
Oh, okay, so you're carrying the whole deal.
Okay, looks like they're ready. Good evening. The Senate Judiciary Policy Committee will reconvene. Our quorum carries over from our meeting earlier this afternoon, and we will take up Senate File 1568. Senator Sharon is the chief author of the bill. We are getting this bill after deadline and very late in the process. And so I guess the first thing I'd like to know from someone from the Department of Human Services is, why are we seeing this massive policy bill in front of the Judiciary Committee several weeks after deadline has passed?
Chair of that. Is there anyone here from Department of Human Services or Department of Health that can answer that question?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber. I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office at the Department.
Mr. Kerber.
And my understanding of the way this came about is the other day in the Health and Human Services Finance Committee, Senator Lurie had noticed as he was pouring through his bill, the department bill, the government's budget bill, that there were a few provisions in there that he that triggered his thought that maybe it ought to go through judiciary, and a couple of them in particular were related to our background studies. And so then what he had asked was, you know, are there, if he said, what he had indicated was that he would feel more comfortable if judiciary had had a look at these provisions. And his instruction was to see whether or not there were other provisions other than these background study provisions. We worked with Ms. Pontius to go through the bill and identify those sections that seemed to be more in the purview of your committee. Those provisions were pulled out quickly and were compiled into a separate bill that Senator Sharon thankfully introduced so that the bill could get the full review.
Mr. Kerber, what I don't understand, these obviously can be separated from the budget bill. They're policy questions. The department certainly has been around long enough to know that we deal with policy in the first half of session, not the second half, by and large. And why were they in a budget bill and not immediately flagged ahead of time that they were judiciary issues if they're relating to data? I mean, that policy area has been a part of Judiciary Committee's jurisdiction for many years. And now the department has put all of us in a very uncomfortable position after deadline of taking. Well, as you can see from this afternoon, we took a very small data practices provision and spent 45 minutes on it because we have to get the language right on these things. So, I mean, we'll take a look at this, and if we're not comfortable that we can get the language done right on this bill, then I'm not going to support passing it out of this committee because I'm not going to keep us here until midnight, and we're not going to come back another day for this at this point in session. So, and I know you just were involved in one of the provisions here, but certainly the department knew a bill this big with these many policy provisions shouldn't be buried in a budget bill, and if they are, they should at least be started early enough that they come to the right policy committee first, not as an afterthought. And because some senators or staff happen to catch that some of the provisions should be heard in different committees. So whoever was responsible for the department bill, the more I look at this, the more I regret even setting it on for a hearing because it looks like about 5 hours worth of committee time, not 1 hour.
Mr. Chair.
We'll do what we can, but we've got other stuff this committee has to hear today, too, because of the legislative schedule. Senator Goodwin?
This, Mr. Chair, just to add to what you said, this is really an extensive, many, many extensive changes to a lot of programs as I'm looking through this bill. And I can also see that it was just introduced on in April 8th. I'm just wondering how much the public has been able to see this bill and be able to respond to it because it just hasn't been there out there for them to do. And if I didn't know better, well, I don't know better, but I kind of think it was just a way to get this through without a lot of public input, and I sure hope that's not the case, because this is very extensive changes.
Senator Goodwin, I understand the budget bill that contained a lot of these policy provisions was introduced earlier, and this here is pulled out as a separate policy bill for our convenience rather than looking through the 600-page budget bill, and it may have to travel on its own or not. Anyway, I don't know exactly when that original budget bill was introduced in the for public review, but certainly as a standalone, this is it is fairly short notice. So, and I mean no disrespect to Senator Sharon. I know you're kind of put in the position of trying to shepherd through a bill that came late to the process. And so we will do our best to make it happen, but not the consequence of not giving fair evaluation to the proposals in here. So why don't we go ahead and move on the merits of the bill then, Senator Sharon. How would you like to proceed?
Thank you. Thank you, Senator, and thank you, committee, for helping us get this bill language in the shape it ought to be. It's you should know that it is a part of the governor's budget bill. So it's calls for many different policy changes, the overall bill, that enhance the oversight of the Department of Health and Human Services and the various programs they operate. And so as a result of the number of changes proposed by the governor that involve background checks, data privacy changes, increased fraud investigation, and the establishment of penalties, it became apparently clear that this bill should have had a chance for the Judiciary Committee to have a look at its language. And so you are correct. There are members of our staff that are here to walk you through the various provisions that relate to background checks, data privacy changes, increased fraud investigations, those things that are the focus in a very large policy bill that relate to this committee. I have an author's amendment and two technical amendments. And I was hoping that Ms. Pontius would be here to explain the technical amendments. The A6 amendment is the author's amendment.
Senator Sharon, we'll get the amendments distributed. And we'll treat all of them as author's amendments, since this is the first committee for the Senate file.
They are the A3, the A7, and the A6 amendments. Two are technical.
Well, then when I suggest we go ahead and adopt them, and then as we review the provisions in the bill, you can address what's contained in the amendments as well. And Ms. Pontius will be here fairly shortly, I understand.
So.
Members, the A3 amendment mostly contains cross-references and some clarifying language for reference purposes, truly a technical amendment. So do the members have the A3 amendment?
A6.
You have the A6.
Should have the A6, the A7, and the A3.
All right. Well, they are all coming.
A6, A7, A3.
So why don't we go ahead and adopt the amendments as author's amendments. Senator Sharon moves adoption of the A6 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Sharon moves the A3 amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Limmer?
Did you say that the A6 was an author's amendment?
Yes, this is the first committee that the Senate file is appearing in front of. So.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Okay.
And the A3 amendment, Senator Scherer moves its adoption. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And then is the A7 amendment on its way around?
It's
in it. 7?
Have we passed the E3 yet? Which amendment is in front of us right now, Senator?
No, the A7. Senator Sharon moves the A7 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, Senator Sharon, the members also have...
Senator Latz?
Yes.
This may be the best time on the A3 amendment. The department sees another statute that should be referenced on line 1.3.
Right now, it currently references...
Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Alex Bartolik. I'm with the Department of Human Services. And on line 1.3, if it read under section 626.556 and 626.557, it will include both child and adult maltreatment.
So Senator Sharon moves on line 1.3 to delete the word section, insert sections 626.556 and. Sound right, Council?
Are you here on?
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, Senator Sharon, we have a memo from Senate Council, which takes us through the bill article by article as it applies to this committee's jurisdiction. Well, that's all of the articles in this particular bill. We think it incorporates the A6 and perhaps the A7 amendments into the Council's summary. How did you wish to proceed? Did you just want to work our way through?
Right. I thought we'd go article by article and work through those elements in here that are for this committee to review.
Okay.
If that's okay with you.
Yep, let's do that.
My understanding for the committee's information that the plan, and I'm just confirming this with you, Senator Latz, is to have this be, if it proceeds through the committee, to go to the floor. But then Senator Lori will be incorporating this into his overall omnibus bill.
That's my understanding, and I think that because it's a late bill that has not gone through rules, that it will, by Senate rule, be automatically sent from the floor into the Rules Committee. And then I guess you and Senator Lori will work it out. If his intent then is to use the content of it into his omnibus bill, then that'll...
Yes. Okay, so then let's move forward. We're going to begin with Articles 1 and 2, and I will just defer to the department to begin to walk you through what it is that's in this bill.
Thank you. Ms. Bartolik?
Mr. Chair, the Article 1 is around three provisions with a new service called Community First Services and Support. And this is actually the next generation of our Personal Care Assistance Program, or PCA services. That has been a longstanding program, has had a number of changes over the year, particularly in 2009. We've been working with an implementation council that is over 50% of people who receive services or their families in designing this service. These three provisions are actually currently in statute for the PCA service, and we're just carrying them over to be part of the Community First Services and Support. And so the first one is making sure that our policies and procedures around this include all the provisions that we currently have in the PCA program around different program integrity and background studies. Subdivision 23 is continuing the authority that currently is found in the PCA program to allow for unannounced visits during regular office hours and immediate access when doing investigations. And Subdivision 24 is, again, looking and carrying forward the same requirements for background studies that we have in our PCA program to this new program, which will replace our PCA program in the future.
Is there a provision to delete separate existing statutory language regarding the PCA, or are you incorporating other rules and regulations into statute?
Second one. At the point that the new statute around the Community First Services and Supports is passed, it will also repeal or delete other sections in statute around the PCA program. So these are current, we're bringing much of the PCA program into the new service, but there will be some differences.
So what we have in front of us is a combination of some statute relating to PCA and some other practices and
Mr. Chair, the three provisions here are currently in our PCA statute, and we're asking to have them apply to the new service in the future.
All right. Is there any particular data provisions relating? I saw that the background check stuff is part of the reference here. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, yes. So the background studies of what information is obtained and how that is used, and also, I mean, that's the primary area, I think, in that provision.
Do you want to go to that? It's on page.
All right, are there any questions from the committee about section one of the bill? All right, why don't you go on to sections two to four.
You're here to talk about which ones?
Four. Okay.
We'll now go through two through four.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jean Wood, and I'm with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to talk about two through four. And this is a proposal to simplify the reporting of maltreatment of vulnerable adults. Currently, 94% of persons with disabilities and the majority of older adults live in the community. And as the population ages, the number of vulnerable people will grow. And our system for reporting maltreatment to provide for the safety needs of these individuals needs to adapt. Under the current system, counties are responsible for designating a common entry point and to receive these reports for the maltreatment of adults 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So Minnesota now has 160 different telephone numbers to call to make a report about the maltreatment of vulnerable adults. In 2010, the common entry points received about 24,000 reports of maltreatment, and in 2012, they received about 32,000 reports. This proposal would simplify the reporting by establishing a single entry point under the Department of Human Services to receive reports of suspected maltreatment through a statewide toll-free number that would replace the current county-designated common entry point system. This proposal also has a centralized database and web-based application for the single reporting system to track maltreatment reports across populations and providers. County Social Services will receive necessary information from the common entry point to respond to imminent danger and immediate need for protective services for vulnerable adults in their county. Once the response center is in operation, DHS would conduct a public outreach campaign to raise the awareness of the issues of vulnerable adult abuse and provide education about where to report suspected maltreatment. The proposal does not change the data practices requirements that govern adult protection data. The centralized common entry point will be subject to the same data practices requirement that govern the current county-based common entry points.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
If we had questions, do you want us to hold them?
No, I'll jump right in while we're on the topic.
All right. Mr. Chair.
Senator Lindman.
I was listening, trying to listen to this, and this is a big subject area, and I am on a fast learning curve right now. So I may have a number of questions to ask. The first question is why would we be changing the investigation point and reporting point from counties, 87 separate organizations, to one? Why is that a benefit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, it is for the purposes of simplifying the reporting for citizens who may be seeing incidences of adult maltreatment in the community. And again, the majority of our vulnerable adults now live in the community. They may be living in their own homes. And so right now, if a citizen sees an event of abuse, neglect, or maltreatment, they would have to find out what number to call, and we have, you know, 160 numbers, and it would depend on the location and time of day what number they would need to use. And our proposal here is to simplify it to one statewide toll-free number to be able to make the report.
Well, the question I have is, you know, most people are kind of trained that if they see abuse of someone, they call 911, and if it's an abuse of a vulnerable adult, the 911 resource will direct them to the right appropriate department or agency. And so I'm just trying to, I live in a suburb of Minneapolis, and we have a number of resources that we could call. But on the other hand, if I lived in Lake County, I probably am pretty well geared that I would call either the county sheriff or 911, and they would get me to the right person immediately. Now, if I'm going to go look for a 1-800 number or a state government agency that I don't know is taking care of this, why would you say that that's better? I don't understand that, and maybe you could sell me on that a little bit.
Okay.
Ms. Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Limmer, I think that there are people who are not necessarily from that county that may see incidents. And so I think that that's one of the challenges. And, of course, with a single toll-free number, if they were to call pretty much anywhere that had some sort of an authority for safety, they would, of course, know the toll-free number and be able to give it to them. So I think that that is a piece of simplification. I think the other part is that there is a lot of financial abuse going on, and so it's not something that people necessarily will call 911 about, but, you know, might go home and think about and consider about how to report this. So not all of our reports involve going through 911.
Ms. Wood, how much of this applies to mandated reporters, and or would reports come in from mandated reporters, and how much would be sort of the average person who happens to run across it?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I mean, much of it, all of it does apply to mandated reporters, and then also to reporters that are voluntary reporters. And so it would apply. There are some pieces of the reporting system that goes to the Department of Health that is done a little bit differently, but for the vast majority of the complaints that we handle, they would come through the common entry point.
And Ms. Wood, I'm sorry, Senator Sherman.
Well, I would just add that to Senator Limmer, one of the other benefits of a centralized point is the centralization and collection of and tracking of the data for trends and for reporting, and then for planning for intervention when we see those trends. So otherwise, we have everybody having to report in order to gather data for us to have a useful set of information to plan with as it relates to abuse of adults and children.
So, Senator Sharon, Ms. Wood, it looks like one of the Considerations for this committee is that it allows electronic reports to be submitted through a web-based reporting system.
Correct.
That's the change in section 2 of the bill, right?
Correct.
So from a data standpoint, going from an other reporting system to an electronic-based.
Correct.
One is of consideration. The section 3 is the one that makes it a common entry point statewide, single point for the entire state. Is that right?
And that's correct.
And it's the data relationship to this committee in particular is the concept of centralizing a database, not from whether that's a good or bad policy as much as the fact that we're now creating a statewide centralized database. Or does such a database already exist? It's just it's harder to assemble it because of the many sources.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, there does already exist a centralized database for these reports. They come in from the 160 numbers and are kept in one place that's under the supervision of the Department of Human Services. And so there is one that does exist now.
Okay, and so Section 3 of the bill then does provide some requirements for how to operate that database.
Correct.
Is that right? And so that's important for this committee to consider from a database standpoint, including the aggregation of statistical reports. I take it when that happens, identifying information for individuals is removed from those kind of aggregate statistical reports?
Yeah, correct.
That's existing policy and practice?
Correct.
And then it looks like there's also provision for creating a system for referring reports to the lead investigative agencies. So the Commission of Human Services does the intake, right, and then distributes investigation to other agencies. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's correct. They would distribute it either back to the county if the person lived in an unlicensed setting. It would go to the Department of Health. If the setting was licensed by the Department of Health, it would go to the Department of Human Services if the setting was licensed by the Department of Human Services.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, are the investigative agencies the BCA? Is that what you're referring to? The BCA would be conducting these, at least a portion of the investigation through its databases?
That is what.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, no, the investigations are done by the Department of Human Services, the Department of Health, and the local county. I assume if they need the BCA to come in because of a necessity that the BCA would come in. But the lead investigative agencies are the County Social Services, Department of Health, Department of Human Services.
Senator Ortman.
Do they check the criminal history databases as part of their investigation?
Is what?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, we would need to ask those agencies what they do. I do the reporting piece. I don't necessarily do the investigations.
Is what your bill's not proposing
not
to make
change.
Changes
change.
In relation
no.
to that process, is it? All right.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that these do get checked against the criminal history database from other testimony we've had on other bills, but just from an understanding of why we have those databases in the first place, the criminal history databases. I'm concerned about the funding for this. Maybe there's a more authoritative answer on that.
Well, as I understand it, Senator Ortman, there's nothing in this bill that proposes to change that process. So whatever funding is held would be held in the Health and Human Services Finance Division, not us, and it's not anticipated there'd be any change in the involvement of the BCA as a result of this bill. So it shouldn't have any impact, is what
they're
telling
us. Well, Mr. Chair, I think it's a fair question to sort out whether these background checks will be checked against the BCA's criminal history database, because we are talking about data now.
Yeah. Senator Ortman, we're not on the background check provision of the bill yet. Is that what you're referring to?
Well, Mr. Chair, I can wait. There are a lot of different investigations that we're talking about in the course of this bill. I can wait if you'd like till we get to that section. I think they have a better answer than
Mr.
the last
Kerber
one.
Mr. Kerber can answer the question if you can.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Jerry Kerber from the Department of Human Services again, and Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, these maltreatment investigations that are done under the Vulnerable Adult Act don't categorically include a review of BCA criminal record information. The people who tend to be, so these are investigations that are done generally when the Department of Human Services is doing it. It's an investigation that we're doing within a licensed facility. Same with the Health Department, as Ms. Wood explained. Coincidentally, the people who work in those programs have to go through a background study that is done by the Department of Human Services as a separate process. And there is a section of this bill that we'll be talking about soon that does make some changes to that system. But as part of this activity for the reporting of the maltreatment, there's no change to the way we interact with the BCA at all in this process. It's merely a way that the reports of alleged or suspected maltreatment come into the agency and then get distributed to the right lead agency.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions on sections 2 through 4 of the bill, of Article 1? Not seeing any. Thank you. Let's move on.
We can proceed to Article 2.
Okay. I'm Christine Borsheim. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, the Child Safety Permanency Division. And I'll be speaking to the provisions in Article 2, the safe and healthy development of children. Specifically, these provisions are part of a department bill called the North Star Care for Children program. That is a program that combines three existing programs, foster care, adoption assistance, and relative custody assistance, into one program and creates uniform benefits for children over the age of 5. And that is done to create, to eliminate one of the barriers to children achieving permanency through adoption or transfer of custody to a relative. Part of what we do to create North Star Care is create a new chapter, 256N. So most of the provisions we'll be talking about are part of that. The five sections that are part of this committee's jurisdiction largely deal with background studies, a section on program integrity, and a section on appeals. The first section, 2, is actually the section that is being amended by the author's amendment.
Which author's amendment was that?
It's the A6 amendment, the first page of the A6 amendment, and a few lines on the second page.
So in order to create North Star Care, which replaces relative custody assistance, it replaces relative custody assistance with guardianship assistance, which is a federal program which allows us to earn Title IV-E funds. And then in order to earn those funds, federal regulations require that a prospective relative custodian must pass a background study. And so that's what Section 2 is about. The way we had originally written the proposal, it looked like we were adding a requirement for a background study, which would look like it would be a barrier to relatives to assume transfer of legal custody. This was brought to our attention by our colleagues in legal services, legal aid, and we worked with them to come up with language that made it clear this is not a new requirement for background study. But it is a background study that's needed to meet Title IV eligibility for a handful of families.
Okay, let's go on.
Okay. The next section, Section 6, contains background study provisions related to the guardianship assistance program. Now, the reason we have this here is that there are current background study requirements, but they need to be moved into the new chapter under North Star Care into 256N. So both Chapter 6 and Chapter 7 really contain the same background studies that already exist, one for guardianship assistance and one for adoption assistance. They exist in the other provisions, and now they'll exist in North Star Care. Section 10. The correct and true information section.
Section 7 in our summary. Is that also?
Yes, that's the adoption assist. I guess I kind of rolled together the Section 6 and 7 right, into one explanation. And like I said, under 7, it's really the identical provisions that exist now under 259A for adoption assistance programs. Section 10 refers to benefits and payments under the North Star Care for Children program. It actually has the identical wording that, again, is already contained in our adoption assistance programs. Basically, what it entails is that that families receiving adoption assistance need to inform us if anything has changed in their circumstance, and if they have not done, if they haven't provided correct and true information, it can be investigated as fraud. The adoption assistance program. This seems appropriate because those adoption assistance funds are public funds.
So, members, specifically Subdivision 21
yes.
is the applicable portion here, and it mandates an investigation for fraud, correct?
Yes. Which, like I said, is existing language under adoption assistance provisions already.
Just incorporating it into the new
We're incorporating it into 256N. And Section 12, very much the same thing, closely follows the language that we already have in the adoption assistance provisions, and it lays out the appeal and fair hearings provisions for families under the guardianship assistance and adoption assistance programs.
Where is the appeal process? Is that within the agency?
Within the department, yes.
The department? You're saying this procedure is already an existing statute?
It's already in the existing adoption assistance statute.
All right. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
And these background studies, they're not defined in this bill. I'm just wondering, do they include the criminal background checks?
I'm going to look. Yes, they do.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Orman.
That's of concern to me. The governor recommended, I think, $16 million for the work that needs to be done for developing the systems and maintaining the systems properly to provide the background checks that you're talking about. And that money was deleted from the budget, the Senate's budget, in the Transportation and Public Safety Committee when it last met. So I'm wondering, I know Mr. Turner isn't here, but how is it that you expect to pay for all of these background checks or provide the funds that the BCA needs in order to bring the systems into an updated fashion to do all this work without the funding?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman.
Portia.
The background study provisions that we're talking about tonight are background studies that are already being done. These are not additional background studies.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Orman.
I understand that. I've heard that said at least three or four times now, but the governor has said, and DPS and BCA has said, they need that money not for more studies, but to provide accurate, timely, and complete information for the background studies we currently do. And I think this bill is a problem. I think any bill that expects the BCA to be able to provide meaningful background checks is in peril without that funding. And I'm trying to figure out what's being proposed to pay for those needed changes.
Senator Ortman, we are in a policy committee, and that finance question is not within our jurisdiction anyway. I'm going to ask us to focus on the policy questions relating to this now, and the appropriate finance committee can address those funding issues when they give it consideration.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
When that occurred in the Judiciary Committee before, the bill came back to us when we acted on our budget to make sure that we had the funds in the Judiciary Committee's budget to support its policy changes. And I'm trying to figure out where is the money in somebody's budget to pay for what's being proposed in these bills. I think it's fair. It should be either
Senator,
in the
Senator Lacks, I think we could quickly answer the question and move on.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, the background studies that are done under this section are background studies we refer to as Adam Walsh background studies, and they're done for the same background study that we do for private adoptions and we do for foster care. And what's significant about those is they not only include a BCA record check, but they also include an FBI record check. When we do them for private adoption agencies, we charge a fee of $70 a piece. The BCA collects a fee from us that covers both our access to their Minnesota criminal records and their facilitation of our getting the FBI records through the BCA. In these cases in particular, when they're initiated by the counties, we have a base level of funding in our general fund that covers these costs. And that's not been affected this year, to any of our knowledge.
Well, Mr. Chair, the BCA has said that there are 168,000 criminal conviction records that can't reconcile into their criminal history database. And so that's what the funding is for. And I'm trying to figure out if the funding that's needed to make these background checks meaningful is if it's not in the public safety budget, is it in the Health and Human Services budget that's going to be proposed? If it's not in the Judiciary Committee's budget, I'm trying to figure out where is the money for that.
Senator Ortman, I'm going to say once again, we are in a policy committee right now. We're not dealing with the finance. This finance question is not within the Judiciary Committee's jurisdiction. So we're not going to spend 15 or 20 minutes debating a non-jurisdictional finance committee question that's not before us.
Well, Mr. Chair, with all due respect, you can pretend that this doesn't cost money, but I'm not going to pretend that, and the citizens of Minnesota aren't going to pretend that. We want these background checks to mean something if we're going to pass them into law. And I think the governor has included that money in his recommendation. I think that it's meaningful that if you're going to have this bill in this committee and ask us to vote for it, it's a fair question to figure out whether it's funded or not.
Senator Ortman, you can take up your concerns with the appropriate finance committee at the appropriate time.
That's what I'm asking, Mr. Chair. Which one is the appropriate finance committee?
Well, it's not this committee, and it's the BCA's budget that has not passed yet, is what I'm told anyway. And so it's not within our jurisdiction. You can take it up with the finance committee that has the BCA's budget in it. And you, as well as any other senator, can find out which committee that is and can address your concerns to the members of that committee.
Mr. Chair.
Senator
Ortman. I've seen the spreadsheet for the Public Safety and Transportation Committee that passed out of that committee, and it zeroed out.
They haven't passed anything out of that committee.
Zeroed out. The spreadsheet includes a zeroing out of the $16.3 million that the governor recommended to improve those databases.
Senator Ortman,
and so,
the
Mr.
Transportation
Chair,
and Public Safety Committee has not passed their budget bill yet. As I understand, it was heard yesterday and was not passed.
You're correct, Mr. Chair. That's what I just learned. I've seen the spreadsheet, so I'm just trying to figure out if it's not in the Public Safety Committee.
It's not
where is
in
that
our
money
committee's
gonna be?
Jurisdiction, Senator Ortman. We're not going to continue a discussion on a finance question that is not within this committee's jurisdiction.
I think it's embarrassing
if you have
that
something
it's
else
not
like
being funded, Mr. Chair.
Well, and you can take that up with members of the Public Safety Committee or on the floor when a bill comes there if you're concerned about that. Let's move on, please.
I'm finished.
That finishes Article 2. The next article is the Department of Human Services Program Integrity article. And Mr. Kerber is here, and is Laura here as well? Okay.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Kerber.
Members, these three sections deal with background studies. Let me tell you what's going on here. There are three sections, and the first and the third are related. What we're doing at the Department of Human Services is in response to a federal grant that we received that is intended. We had to make some commitments about changing our background study system. We got a $3 million grant to modify the infrastructure for our process. We do about 270,000 background studies a year, over 1,100 a day. And we're going to be moving toward a more of a fingerprint-based background study system. Right now, the only time we get people's fingerprints is if we're going to go to the FBI to get their records. And that's not for this session, and we anticipate that we'll be having a lot more of that conversation in the future and the next legislative session. But what we're proposing this year is some of the base level changes to our process are two things. One is that we are pursuing access to the BCA's predatory offender registry. And so the part of the language here gives us that access to the predatory offender registry. And in fact, that was one of the amendments in the A7 amendment. It was a conforming change. There's a couple statutes that talk about that. 299C addresses it, as does the predatory offender registry itself, 243. And the issue there is related to when we do a routine background study, we're looking to see if somebody has a criminal record in Minnesota. And somebody may have a criminal record in another state and they have moved to Minnesota, and our system doesn't currently catch that information from another state unless they happen to be identified at the BCA as a multi-state offender, or we get some other information from somebody indicating the person has a record in another state. And so there could be cases where somebody may be even a registered sex offender in another state and they move to Minnesota and they're properly registered as a predatory offender, as you know, we call them predatory offenders here. They could be properly registered as a predatory offender, but we're not going to know that in doing our background study. The state of Wisconsin and the state of Illinois more recently did an audit to see a cross comparison between their sex offender registry and their child care providers, and found that they had issued child care provider licenses, family child care provider licenses, to many homes where there were registered sex offenders living. And so it was sort of a right hand and left hand kind of a thing that with government data. And so we're pursuing that. It's required for our federal grant that ultimately we will be doing nationwide sex offender registry checks. But as a start, we need to be checking our Minnesota predatory offender registry. And so that's what those are. To pay for this, we have a federal grant, and we've been meeting with the BCA, and so we've worked out with the BCA that they aren't going to charge us any additional information for this. When we do a routine background check, we'll probably just get a flag indicating yes or no whether this person there's somebody with that similar name on the sex offender registry or the predatory offender registry, and then we'll go in on a one-by-one basis and see what's there and see whether or not it's concerning us for this background study. So that's one of the provisions.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Orban.
If the state grants a license, but there had been information about a criminal background or a predatory offender, the license is issued, and then that person reoffends, is there liability to the state if that happens?
Madam Chair and Senator Orban, when we do a background study on somebody and we permit them to work in a human services environment or health department license program, so in the healthcare industry, it's not really any indication that they're not going to reoffend or they're not going to offend for the first time. Ideally, what we're doing is we're sorting out those people that may commit maltreatment against one of the vulnerable adults or the children receiving services. There have been cases where somebody had committed maltreatment, not a lot, but there have been a couple over time where somebody had committed maltreatment and later was discovered that they had some criminal history that we didn't see in our routine background study. And we look at those cases very seriously to figure out how did we miss this process in our process. And so the second change kind of relates a little bit more towards that, but people have brought actions against us and so far we haven't lost any of those cases. I mean, we're very diligent about how we carry out our statutory duties.
Mr. Gerber, Ms. Pontius has something to add to this.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, if you look at the State Tort Claims Act, and I think there's something parallel in the Municipal Act as well, there's immunity for a loss based on the failure of a person to meet the standards needed for a license, permit, or other authorization issued by the state or its agents. I don't know if that kind of... So if they were to issue a license and didn't get it, where somebody would have been disqualified, but they didn't get the information, they would be immune from liability.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gerber, you talked about a $3 million grant from the federal government. Is that a one-time funding, or is that something that the federal government intends on keep sending out to states?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, it's a one-time federal grant over a three-year period. And so during this three-year period, our intent is to, you know, get this system as designed as much as we can, but along the way, coming back to the legislature to approve the necessary changes in the law that will need to be made. And we're being paid this $3 million, not all at once, but it's kind of being trickled out to us as we go. And so over the next couple of years, we're going to be having some very important discussions about fingerprinting everybody, requiring the fingerprints of everybody who wants to work in a child care center, for instance, or a chemical dependency treatment program. Everybody wants to work in a nursing home or a hospital or a home health agency, or anybody's doing PCA services. You know, before we can simply start requiring that, we're going to be coming back and seeking the specific authority to do so. So we're a long way from this thing totally being rolled out, but what we are getting is we're getting some free access to a pretty interesting data system that's going to be made available that, nevertheless, even if we don't end up going the full distance on these reforms, as we hope, we're still going to have a much better data system in place.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
One thing I might want to remind the committee on is we get promises from the federal government and the lure of grants all the time. And very rarely are they ever over a long duration. We all remember the Clinton cops that in order to take care of urban crime, they gave grants for 3 years to hire law enforcement, new personnel. And then after 3 years, the federal government withdrew their money. And then you had all sorts of unemployment compensation issues, or you had to immediately come up with cash, the local political subdivisions. We've also had that in the state of Minnesota. We had a fusion grant where the federal government wants us or the BCA to collect all sorts of data, not just conviction data, not just arrest data, but all kinds of data on individuals, your neighbors, and any other paltry type of information on private citizens. And it's sent to the Fusion Center. A Fusion Center is a partnership between federal and state government. And then within about a year or two, they withdrew their $6 million and demanded that we pick up the $6 million. And the information then is not shared. We just give it to the federal government, and we keep giving the information to the federal government, and they don't share anything with us. That's just kind of a pattern of what we've been dealing with in the state. Now, I would imagine that after this $3 million is used up, now maybe it's just for the initiation of this process, but we will have to pick up a tailing effect on the expenses. The other thing is I'm a little concerned that we seem nationwide, not just in this area of law, but the federal government seems to throw out a grant and they expect us to collect all sorts of fingerprints on all sorts of law-abiding citizens and then send them to the federal government for their enshrinement in files. And I understand why it's important to have fingerprints when you collude that information with background checks, especially with vulnerable populations. But we are getting to the point where we are developing a definite pattern, a very fast developing pattern in this country that everyone's fingerprints are soon to be collected by the federal government. And I don't know if we get anything but maybe a false sense of security out of it. Just a word of caution when we do this. But the lure in this particular case might be the $3 million in addition to whatever else the federal government's
Wanted
to give us.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Yes, sir.
Mr. Kerber, Section 1 of Article 3 gives the Commissioner of Human Services access to the database with sex offender registration when they conduct their background checks under existing law. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
All right. And Section 2 provides for an electronic process for the regular transfer of new criminal history information.
He's trying to keep us focused.
So that the database is up to date. Is that correct, Mr.
Chair? Yeah. Section 2 is really is unrelated to the predatory offender registry, and it's Section 2 is the other major change that we're pursuing here, and it establishes a different relationship the different relationship with the MNSIS system, the Minnesota Court Information System, maintained by the Supreme Court. What this will do, and this is kind of looking forward, so that, as Senator Limmer had mentioned, we're not left with an enormous amount of cost at the end of this this 3-year period where we have this grant money. We need to do some very significant changes to the way we do background studies. As I mentioned, we do 1,100 a day. Many of those are on people we've already done a background study on. People change jobs, and when they're looking for a new job, they apply to many different places. And so we're doing a background study essentially on the same person many times over the course of their career to see whether or not essentially something new has been added to their criminal file. What this does is it builds a different system where on a routine basis we would be getting from the MNSIS system information that's already considered by them to be public data, but we would be getting it electronically from them. And when we get that data about new criminal activity that's entered into that system, we develop a process that filters out all the information about all the people that we don't care about. The only people we want criminal history information on are people who are actively working in the programs that we regulate, and PCA services and health department license programs. We don't want criminal record information on anybody else. And so this requires us to build a system that will get that data on a regular basis. And so if we do a background study on me because I work in a mental health program, and we did a background study on me 2 years ago, if I reoffended last week, the Department of Human Services would get that new offense information on me. And the department could act on it, rather than trying to figure out, is there some way to routinely go back and check if something new is added to the record.
So the fact that your agency has done a background check in the past on a particular individual will cause the system to notify your agency if that person has a change in their criminal background.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly right.
All right. But Section 3, please.
And then Section 3 is the corresponding language in our background study law that just gives us the authority to look at that information. Otherwise, our background study chapter is very controlling on as it should be, on how we access information and what information how we handle information and who we share it with. So Section 3 is conforming provisions.
All right. Section 4.
Section 4 is a different section entirely. In Section 4 is...
Never mind.
Section 4 is related to our creation of a new child care assistance fraud investigative function within the Department of Human Services. Currently, there is no administrative agency that has responsibility for, or technically even the authority to investigate when a provider is engaged in fraudulent activities with our child care assistance program. It's a pretty significant gap in our system. And so what we're proposing at the department is to create an investigative unit. Most of the subdivisions in here are designed after what we already have in place for Medicaid fraud investigations related to providers. So there's not a lot of new concept here, but it's the same old concepts that are being applied to child care providers. And I can go through these section by section, Mr. Chair, if there are any in particular that you're most interested in hearing about.
Well, if there's anything that treats data any differently than existing law does.
Mr. Chair, not that it does. And I think there's a provision in here that identifies that the data that we collect in this process is classified under 13.4.6 and is considered the same as licensing data. We're not really inventing a whole lot new here except for the investigative functions. There are some sanctions that we refer to, but those are sanctions that already exist in law, and the appeal processes for those sanctions already exist. What we have is a different responsibility for investigation and then applying those other sanctions as they already exist. There is a provision here about giving access to the commissioner, and that is that's subdivision 6. Saying that a provider, license holder, controlling individual, employee, staff person, or recipient has an affirmative duty to provide access to information. If we're denied access, again, according to other existing provisions in law, the provider gets a 15-day notice that they need to provide us that access, and if they haven't provided us that access at the end of the 15 days, then there's a consequence. They get to appeal that consequence. There are a lot of appeal rights that already exist under the child care assistance statutes, 119B, and we're sort of just piggybacking on all that. The first thing we're trying to do is to kind of get our toe in the water as an investigative agency investigating these kinds of allegations of fraud committed by child care providers. We already have some investigation of recipients, but this is for providers.
I see subdivision 14. There's immunity from liability for reporters who are not involved in the alleged misconduct. Does that provision also mirror comparable provision in other investigative statutes?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's very similar to what we have in the Medicaid system. And so if somebody, they're immune, if they have not been in collusion really on the fraud itself, they're immune if they come forward. But then if they had been involved, their participation in the investigation is a mitigating factor when determining whether or not the sanction is appropriate for the individual.
And appeal process is the same as in other areas as well?
Same as, Mr. Chair, it's the same as it exists now. Many of these are fair hearings. In a couple cases, they get to contested case hearings.
Okay. Any questions from the committee on Article 3?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lemon.
Mr. Kerber, when the agency is acting as an investigative agency, does your agency, is it qualified for criminal investigation and evidence collection and seizure?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lemon, we don't. We don't. We've investigated whether or not from the get-go, we want to be considered to be part of the criminal justice system, and therefore have access to that same data. It gets very complicated because you have to have a licensed police officer who's supervising people then. I mean, there are a whole lot of other regulations that come with that. What we're choosing to do in the first year, at least, is to have a very collaborative relationship with the BCA. And we're kind of working on establishing, an interagency agreement right now with that. So our hope is that when we're doing these investigations, we'll be able to complete them in a way that more or less tees them up for the county attorney. We met with a lot of county attorneys, and while there are concerns about child care assistance fraud, depending on where you are and when you're there, whether or not that's going to get a full law enforcement investigation and the county attorney's time in prosecuting kind of depends on how much money we're talking about, what's really at stake here. Our interest is really going after more and more of those cases, and in our conversations with county attorneys, we want to package them up better. We want to be working with them so that we're investigating them and putting together the case for an easier prosecution. So that's where we're going to be working really in collaboration with law enforcement agencies, especially the BCA.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Lemmer.
When one collects evidence of a wrongdoing or a crime, we rely on trained law enforcement to do that. And it's specifically referenced for law enforcement to do it because they are trained. If your agency is not trained and you're going to be collecting reports, stories, physical evidence of wrongdoing, I would tend to think that you might be bordering on a tainted evidence standard. And any evidence that you would have collected to hand over to law enforcement agencies for the purposes of a prosecution will have been ruined. And I think there is a very specific reason why we have law enforcement doing this type of investigation. I can understand perhaps the purposes of licensure, but in the other areas, reporting vulnerable adult maltreatment, a report is one thing, but evidentiary investigations and seizure of evidence is quite definitely another. How do you vindicate that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, those are exactly the kind of conversations we've been having about when does the evidence that's collected during an administrative investigation, when is that appropriately used for a criminal prosecution? And it isn't easily used in that case. And so that's where we actually, many of our investigators that we have today are retired law enforcement officers. Fortunately for us, they need to retire at an early age when they're available for us to hire. And so we do have law enforcement, retired law enforcement staff on our payroll. What we're looking for with our collaboration with the BCA is to figure out when in the course of one of these investigations it really is tripping over into a criminal investigation, and then conduct it in that fashion as a criminal investigation so that the prosecution can occur without it being tainted by collecting information under a different guise.
Thank you, Mr. Kerber. Senator Limmer.
Thanks, Chair. Mr. Kerber, you made mention of retired law enforcement. In many cases, unless they keep some type of credential, and that usually means they have to be employed, they lose their standing as a qualified law enforcement investigative officer. And you don't take a police officer off the street and simply because he's retired, he's now an investigator qualified to collect evidence. They might protect the scene of an evidentiary location, but they don't collect it. I'm a little concerned that this might need a little bit more ferreting out. Did you know that even the Capitol security that we used to have here, the guys that ran around in the maroon jackets, you don't see them anymore. Those were all retired. And the reason why they were retired is they aren't real cops anymore. They're retired. And the liability that we had here in the state capitol was so strong that we had to lay them off. And you're telling me that you might use the same type of employment pool for evidentiary collection. I'm very concerned about that.
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, those are all excellent points. And I don't want to overrepresent the function of this investigative unit is for criminal prosecution. There are cases certainly when we will be making those referrals for a full criminal investigation, and through our collaborative relationship with the BCA, we'll be knowing when that's the case. The primary interest here is to develop an administrative investigative function. Currently, there are mechanisms in place for those criminal investigations, and it's just that these cases don't often hit the threshold to get entered into that system. But at the same time, we want there to be an administrative function here that looks into these so we can turn off the tap in these cases sooner and get recoveries from these providers. So administratively, we will investigate, we'll determine there's a program violation, we will stop the payments, and we will pursue recoveries. Some of these early on will trigger a referral for a law enforcement investigation. I don't want to overrepresent that we're going to hold ourselves out as doing law enforcement investigations, but we're going to be collaborating with those who do. Primarily with the BCA. So your points are excellent, and it's all part of the ongoing discussion, and I don't want to overrepresent that we are going to be acting as law enforcement agency. As I said, we investigated that early on, and, you know, there's a lot of issues with that.
All right, Article 4.
Before going to Article 4, may I draw your attention to the amendment, the A6 or the author's amendment. Can't remember where I put it here. It is the A6 amendment on page 2. There is an addition to page 78 in which we add a mentally ill and dangerous commitment stakeholder group. I just want to make certain that you know that is also in the bill. I think that most of you are familiar that the state auditor did an audit of state-operated human services, made a report to the legislature. So this language that's in front of you from the A6 amendment really is a response to that, to establish a stakeholder group to begin to develop recommendations in response to the auditor's report. And so that's what that language is, and I wanted to make certain that you knew that it was included in this bill.
Article 4.
And so we go to Article 4. Article 4. Who's going to be covering Article 4?
Mr. Chair, I'm Alex Bartolik from DHS. The waiver provider standards have several provisions in this bill, and to give you some background, we currently have about 37,000 people that are being served through four home and community-based disability waivers and one waiver program for people who are older. Every waiver and every service has had different standards and some different licensing. This process of developing a cohesive set of waiver provider standards for our home and community-based services is resulting in a new license called 245D. And so in developing this 245D, we have taken from some existing standards but then also strengthened others. So that's the context for these waiver provider standards. This is pertinent to a new license that will be implemented as of January 1st, 2014. Section 2 around psychotropic medication is talking about the requirements for administering psychotropic medications and some of the provisions related to it. This is in addition to regular medication management, which is covered in another area. And this basically draws from the requirements for psychotropic medications that currently exist for people with developmental disabilities. We worked with the mental health community to look at how to assure that these standards are appropriate regardless of a person's diagnosis. And what is in this section are the requirements for the new license in order to manage psychotropic medications. Section 3 is talking about some different protection standards, and again, this is around management of funds. It is taking many of the same provisions that currently are in licensing standards that currently are in place and bringing them over to the new licensing rule that we have. The one change, that couple of changes in here, under subdivision 4 in B on page 87, this is one, taking an exemption that currently people who are guardians or conservators are considered a related individual. They are exempt from licensure, so it's taking them out and making it clear that we are talking about attorneys and to prevent a license holder from being able to have that authority, the power of attorney for someone that they are serving. And then also to assure that if the person died or left that provider, that all of the funds or property would be returned to the person or their guardian or legal representative along with any information. And then the third area is Section 6, and this is in the author's amendment. It is related to some of the policies and procedures that must be in place for more intensive services, and this is just a type of provider that has responsibilities for training and habilitation, and it's talking about data practices. And what we have done in this section for these policies and procedures for providers is be more specific about the types of data practices that they are to follow and being very specific in giving them the references. Before, it was a more general statement, so in this new licensing standard, we've been very specific to reference the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act as well as HIPAA.
Members, this was Section 6 of the A6 Amendment.
Bottom of page 4.
In particular, the bottom of page 4 has a data privacy provision, subdivision 3.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
On page 5 of the A6 amendment, starting on lines 3 through 6, there's a reference to the license holder must comply with HIPAA.
in implementing regulations, Title 45, Parts 160, 164. Could you tell me what that reference is about?
Just a moment.
not specifically, I don't.
Just a moment. We will see if we can get that reference for you.
We'll have to come back to that.
All right. Senator Sharon says we'll get the information to you, Senator Lemon.
Right.
But the main part of that data privacy provision is that the license holder is going to have to comply with all of the data protections that are included in the listed statutes. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lemon.
If there is a conflict between state law and federal law, which one takes precedent?
Just a moment.
Federal law.
We'll get back to you. I know that we have some people in the room who can help me with this one.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, Jerry Kerber again. I think generally what we do is we go with the stricter interpretation, the stricter requirement. Whichever would apply.
All right.
Okay. That concludes Article 4. Article 5.
Okay, we're moving to the Department of Health, Article 5. This section relates to provisions for home care providers. And Susan Winkleman from the Department of Health is here to review that section.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Winkleman. I'm the Assistant Division Director in the Minnesota Department of Health Compliance Monitoring Division, and among other things, we regulate and license home care providers. Article 5 is relating to home care providers. Just to give you a little bit of a background so you'll understand what these changes are, and in particular the sections that relate to the jurisdiction of your committee. Home care provider licensing is being restructured and streamlined. There are some new consumer protective enhancements being added, and we also did a reorganization of the statutory provisions. So many of the provisions that relate to this committee's jurisdiction are actually in current law, except there are a few changes. So I would be able to go through and at least pick out the new or different changes from what is already in existing law. The author's amendment contains a number of changes that are relating to the three home care provider organizations, and we've been working with them diligently over the past couple of weeks to come up with changes that satisfy their concerns about this proposal. And so that is what is in the author's amendment. I think there's some...
Can you point us to a provision, Ms. Winkleman?
Sorry. It's at the... It begins, the changes related to Article 5 begin on line 5.34, and they extend through the end at 8.25. Would you like me to go through the amendment pieces or the sections of the
Please.
Article? Okay, I can start with the author's amendment. Starting on line 5.34, this is taking the 626.556 and 626.557, which refer to the Maltreatment of Minors Act and the Vulnerable Adults Act. It's removing that those from our correction order provisions. There's actually a very robust process already in existence in both the Vulnerable Adults Act and the Maltreatment of Minors Act about violations of those provisions and what needs to be done. So it was really a mistake on our part to have included it as part of our correction order process. So we're removing that. starting on line 5.35 and extending through, let's see, where does this go? Through 6.30. All of that relates to fines. The providers that had a number of concern regarding how we were proposing to assess fines, that they were too large, and that they really did not distinguish between the violation type very well. And so what we did is that we worked with the providers to come up with different seriousness levels of fines so that, depending on the violation, it wasn't all the same. A violation is not a violation. So you can tell between a level one, which would be the most technical of violations, all the way to something that's very serious and potentially cause death, which would be a level four violation. And then also we added in a scope of violation provision, which is isolated in a pattern or widespread. All of those together read so that we are putting more detailed information into our correction orders about exactly what happened and how serious it is. So that was something that the providers wanted, and we were able to come up with this language. Let's see, 6.31 and 6.33, I believe, are readability. I've got different cheat sheets here I need to refer to. There's delete 6.35, delete lines 15 through 18. That was our former fining section, and so that's removing that and then is substituted with the levels of fines and also the new scope of fines. Then there's some re-lettering in 6.36. And then from 7.1 to, oh, I think it's 7.7, there was some language that the Department of Health inadvertently brought into its proposal in the first place, and we apologize for that. The providers pointed out our error, and it was due to some drafting that we had been doing, borrowing DHS licensing ideas, and we scooped up some language that actually is in 245C. It should not be in our licensing package, and so we're removing that. Then we have some readability changes in 7.10 and all the way through 7.14. Starting 7.15 through 8.14, this is also an agreement that we came to with the providers. It was to give more detail about a reconsideration process. In our original proposal, we had included a reconsideration process, but there weren't very many details to it. This adds a lot more detail and a lot more requirement on the part of the department to have a checks and balance system so that the staff who are reviewing the reconsideration request are not the staff who already reviewed or made decisions about the original correction order. So it's an additional kind of separation of function and checks and balance system. And then we have the last change in the author's amendment, which starts at 8.15 and goes to the end, 8.23. And this is the addition of a study that will commence July 1, 2015 to give us some time to get our new licensing system into place. And that we will report to the legislature February 2016 about whether or not there's a need for an independent outside review of the correction orders. And so the reconsideration is an internal kind of informal review, but this would be a study by the department to decide whether or not we should add an additional correction order review process by an outside independent party. And that concludes the author's amendment portions. Would you like me to go through the changes in the?
Yeah, why don't you go back then to Article 5 specifically.
Okay. Article 5, sections 1 through 4, sections 1 through 4 are data practices provisions. The data practices provisions that we currently have that are regulating home care providers is not very specific. And so we wanted to make sure that we had licensing data and correction data information about how it's going to be used, who it will be shared to, and all of that, just very transparently set out in details. The definitions, private, public, and confidential, of course, are taken right from Chapter 13, and so we're not changing anything in Chapter 13. And so the data classification in Section 1 is private data, and that is the data that is submitted on licensing applications before the license is issued, and the identity of complainants, and social security numbers, of course, and health record data. Section 2 specifies what is public data, and that is application data on licensees and licensing information for other licenses held under the same chapter, final enforcement actions after a contested case proceeding in Chapter 14, orders for hearing, and then the final item 6 probably relates to a stipulation and consent order, a settlement agreement after it's executed. Section 3 relates to the confidential data, and that is what's typically confidential, which is active investigative data relating to investigations of the licensee, and that's before a final order is issued. And then finally, in Section 4, we have release of private or confidential data, and that specifies who may receive the private or confidential data. And we have the list, except for social security numbers, to appropriate state, federal, or local agency and law enforcement offices to enhance investigative enforcement efforts. And then we've included a list of typical offices of those that name. The Ombudsman's Office, the Department of Human Services, city or county attorney's offices, police, local or county health officials.
Ms. Winkleman, on line 25 and 26 there, in addition to investigative enforcement efforts, it says, or further public health protective process. What does that mean?
Well, the intent there was to really refer to the following offices' names, because really the Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care and Office of Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities do not have investigative or enforcement authority. However, they are relevant parties when there is a serious action taking place.
I wonder if it should be somehow specified in the bill that those are the types of offices or the offices that you're referring to. And I also wonder whether it's your intent that even after release that this private or confidential data remains private or confidential as to the other offices that receive it.
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent point, and I think we would be definitely it's a good idea to note that the public health protective offices that we mean are the following, and then also what you pointed out secondly was something that's commonly within the Chapter 13, which the data will be held the same classification in the receiver as it was in the provider. So the provider of the data gives the agency the data, and then the receiver of that data must also maintain that classification. So I think those are good suggestions.
Ms. Pontius reminds me that it retains its protected status when it's released to another government agency.
Okay.
But your language here leaves open at least the possibility of releasing it to non-governmental agencies that may in some way further public health protective process.
What page and line was that?
Page 95, lines 25 and 26.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Pontius, is the reference to line 24, a release to state, federal, or local agency and law enforcement office, is that self-limiting so that whatever follows in that paragraph, the more open language, would still be limited to some kind of a state, federal, or local agency and law enforcement office?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I believe that's correct. And then there's examples of types of offices, and all of those are, in fact, you know, government entities.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Limmer.
On line 26, there's also a reference to types of offices include, but not limited to. Does it mean you can send it anywhere you want?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, no, that is not the intent by the not limited to. It was intended to not be restricted in case one of these offices changes their name, if something like that. So it definitely is not the intent to broaden it to any office beyond a public protective office, public health protective office.
Is that term defined somewhere in statute, public health protective processes?
Mr. Chair, no.
You coined a new
not
phrase?
Not to my knowledge.
I wonder if we can find some language that has more commonly understood meaning or somehow give a little more guidance to who might get. I mean, this is a long list, and you know, that's fine as long as the data is protected, but. That's your intent, though, is basically any agency that does these kinds of investigations should have access to the data? Is that the point?
Yeah. I mean, Mr. Chair, the intent of this is that when we're collecting information that may be of interest to another agency that's also conducting a similar investigation, we ought not be kept in our silos but be able to collaborate and further that process. But, of course, keeping in mind that the private and confidential data status needs to be retained by the receiving agency.
Should you say that?
I think we've certainly laid the appropriate legislative record to that effect. I just want to make sure our language clearly enough reflects that to give guidance to those who read it. Welcome suggestions from counsel if there's any better way to do it.
Senator, well, if... the language I heard was when conducting similar investigations. Is that the language that would narrow? It's the release to these agencies, and then it's narrowed by that. I thought I heard you narrow the language for what the purpose for which it would be released to these agencies.
The current language now in line 25 is to enhance investigative or enforcement efforts, or further public health protective process, and to facilitate, is what you're suggesting, counsel, instead of enhance?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, that is acceptable.
Also, possibly after the word further on line 25, insert the. So it would read, they could release the data to facilitate investigative or enforcement efforts or further the public health protective process. Does that seem to implement
Mr.
your
Chair,
intent?
That sounds really good.
Senator Limmer, what do you think?
Well, it's, Mr. Chair, you have to admit it's difficult to write this on the fly. It's I understand that you're trying to make the language better. I've still got misgivings about the but are not limited to reference on line 26. The difficulty with doing this is that we're forced to do this rather quickly with very limited time, and we've been working at it now for 2 hours, going on 2 hours now. And I suppose we could pick at this thing all night, and there's still a number of answers that haven't been given to some of the questions. So I want to help, but at the same time, I'm not sure if we're going to get there entirely to satisfy much of my concern about this.
Mr. Chair?
In order to satisfy Senator Latz, with your permission, we could eliminate but are not limited to. And I'd add that to the amendment to add language facilitate on line 95.25 and the.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think it means the same thing. I know as a drafting style, include as just examples. So some people say include but not limited to. I find it to be redundant, but sometimes people read it differently.
Well, the alternative is to not specify any offices, just delete. I mean, it's a little, isn't it a little unusual in statute to kind of list examples? Or so we could let's adopt Ms. Pontius's drafting style. Delete but are not limited to?
Comma not, yeah.
Delete on line 26, delete comma but are not limited to comma. And then if we leave the lists in there, it will certainly include those offices, but be broad enough under the ambit of the language on lines 25 and the first part of 26 to be more inclusive if they fit within the government agency requirements. Maybe not wholly satisfying, but helpful. I hope Senator Sharon makes that motion.
Yes, I do.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
There are a few other bills and authors waiting and other people here to testify, and this has been a pretty drawn-out process. I'm wondering if it's maybe in everyone's best interest to shift the order here to get to some of these other folks, and so I would move to lay the bill on the table temporarily and take it up when we've finished the other business before the committee.
Well, I have to ask counsel for guidance because we have to go into the finance division to conduct all the other business that's waiting for us. And I don't know if that means we can, I don't know if we can recess the policy committee and convene as a finance division. We could do that.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't know for an absolute fact, but I would suspect that you could. You're properly noticed and everything. You could recess policy, adjourn, convene the division, take care of your business, and then reconvene policy if you choose.
Does the committee have any particular preference one way or the other?
Mr. Chair, it's non-debatable.
Senator,
the motion.
Well, you're making a motion to lay the bill on the table, but your motion included some procedural provisions relating to the conduct of the committee's business beyond just laying it on the table. So,
well, Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I think that the motion was to lay the bill on the table. If there's no other business before the committee, then it can recess and reform as the budget committee and then take up the business of the policy committee later.
Okay. I'm going to take your motion as a motion simply to lay the bill on the table, since it's not an appropriate motion to decide the procedure for the conduct of the rest of the committee.
I think.
So Senator Ortman moves to lay Senate file 1568 on the table. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, what we are going to do is recess now as the policy committee. We're going to take a 5-minute break so that we can stretch our legs and be ready for the next phase of this action tonight. In 5 minutes, we will reconvene. We will convene as the Finance Division. We'll hear the bonding bills. When we're done with that, we will adjourn, and then we will reconvene as the Policy Division to conclude Senate Policy Committee to conclude Senate File 1568. Committee's in recess.